We believe that alcoholism is a disease and that Alcoholics Anonymous is one solution to that disease. I'm here to bring you the voices of its members. Everyone that comes on the show, including myself, is an active member and has found recovery in the rooms of AA. As you listen, please take what works for you and leave the rest.
I'm Sarah O'Flynn, and my sobriety date is May 26, 2014. And Tara, thank you very much for asking me to share my experience, strength, and hope, or what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, it's interesting. I'm, 6.5 years sober, and I've heard in the rooms before that, you know, our story can change. And because the longer I'm sober and the longer I'm recovered, I have a clarity about my life that I don't think I had before. So, I grew up in a real loving family. And most of what you hear from me or what will come out of my mouth, a lot of it is taken from other speakers. I love listening to speakers. I love listening to the old speaker tapes and podcasts, and it's really been a mainstay of my recovery. It's kept me engaged and kept me drawn in. But I've often heard, you know, the Irish Catholic family referred to as the CIA or the Catholic Irish alcoholic, and so I qualify, although I am fourth generation. Possibly fifth, but anyway, a big Irish Catholic family, six of us. And, you know, for a long time, alcohol was fun because my family, when we were being raised and growing up, my mother was great at making us all feel really special and birthdays, you know, were a celebration. And it was, you know, what's your favorite cake? And we all, would gather in the dining room and she'd have the balloons and then as we grew older, you know, when we were old enough to have a drink, that became part of it as well as, you know, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Easter. My mother was just the absolute best when it came to holidays. And so as I grew older, I'll try to stick to myself. You know, I looked more and more forward to those family gatherings because I could, you know, sip the wine and I loved it. And, you know, I'm not saying we were the perfect family, but we weren't, you know, a lot of times you'll hear people share that there was abusive alcoholic behavior or there was fighting or there was this and that. We were pretty cheerful and happy. Not all the time, but, you know, alcohol for me early on was a happy thing. And then in high school and college, everybody partied. That's the way I looked at it. And, this is back in the 80s and the 90s. And I just, you know, didn't think really anything of it. I did like a white substance that was going around in the 80s quite a bit. But the good news is, for me, is I also was careful with money. So I didn't want to blow my money all the time. So I was kind of able to get out of that. But, you know, I've had an interesting relationship with alcohol. And the longer I'm sober, the longer, the more I just look back and wonder, like, how long was I the alcoholic? And just the other day, a thought came into my head that has come up now and again. And I remember being, I don't know, maybe 19, 20. And I was driving drunk or buzzed in a neighborhood not far from where I grew up. And I was listening to the radio and smoking a cigarette. And I was thinking to myself, man, this feels so good. Like, I can see why I want to feel like this all the time. And the only reason why I think I didn't drink all the time that young is because I also was raised by parents that instilled a lot of responsibility in me. You know, my father worked for the railroad and retired with them as a marketing executive for many years. And he was a good dad and he expected us to, you know, get our homework done and, you know, keep our rooms clean. And he was my hero pretty much. I've often talked to my older siblings about how I'm one of the youngest. And so the dad I had was different than the dad they had. He mellowed quite a bit by the time I was, in high school and college. And then, you know, my mom, she moved several times for his career. But being one of the younger kids, I ended up in the same high school, the same grade school, the same, you know, school system all along, whereas my older siblings got moved around a lot because of his career. But, you know, again, partying for me wasn't a huge deal. If I got in trouble for it, which I did occasionally, friends of mine were getting in trouble for it too. So I didn't think of it as a big deal. I commuted to Cal State Northridge from LA, you know, stayed at home. And I started going to this great Irish bar in LA and essentially ended up marrying my bartender. So I you know, went through the gamut of guys that were partiers too. And, you know, basically I felt like most of them were losers, but, you know, maybe they were looking at me the same way too, who knows. But, you know, I met this guy and he hadn't been here very long from Ireland and he didn't drink. And I was so attracted to him because he was just this really nice guy and goodness just, you know, kind of came out of him. You could just see he was a good guy and fell in love with him. And got through college. Actually, I met him after college. And, you know, it's interesting because part of my story is that he and I really grew up together. You know, we're coming out the other side of the divorce. And a lot of my story is about how my drinking was fueled in my 30s and 40s. And back then, you know, my story went something like, well, you drink too if you had my life. He became really ill. And I was juggling the kids and juggling a career and trying to help him. And little by little by little, my excuse became, well, I need to be home for my husband. You know, I need to be home for him. When the truth really is that being home for him also afforded me an opportunity to drink the way I wanted to drink. And I give my kids a lot of credit for helping me stay at least out of danger for a very long time, because I learned from my mother, you know, what it was to be a good mom. And I know that she, you know, sacrificed quite a bit for us in terms of like, she put our needs first. And when I was expecting the kids and when they were little, you know, I didn't want to drink while I was pregnant. And again, that was just, you know, I was just blessed by my upbringing. And my alcoholism hadn't fully taken hold. So I guess when I look back on it, I really see the progression of the alcohol. And I'm not a person who ever had a pink cloud. You'll often hear in the rooms, you know, I had a pink cloud. And when I got sober, everything was wonderful. That is not part of my story. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I did not want to be in it. I didn't want a part of it. And it pains me sometimes to say that I was a snob. I was like, no, I don't want to be in those rooms with those meetings. And the way I first came into the rooms is, you know, I had that great big Irish Catholic wedding and, it was really a beautiful wedding. I look back on it. It's one of the best weddings I've ever been to. And, he didn't want to raise our children in the LA area. He was from a small town in Ireland, so he really wanted them to have a good upbringing. So, or not necessarily good is maybe the wrong word. He wanted a small town. We couldn't afford a home in LA. There was no way. So he talked me into moving out to the desert, which I was like, I am not moving out to that place. I mean, it's hot and it's all old people and I'm not going there. But he talked me into it because I had only seen the desert like in the 70s and the 80s. But the desert really grew and there was these lovely little neighborhoods and we found this great house and, I was able to get this great job. And, you know, that's probably where I first learned or suspected that I had a problem. I got this great pharmaceutical job, not long after moving to the desert. The kids were 5 and 8, I want to say. And my father, he died unexpectedly. And it was just really horrible. And, you know, he was my mentor and he was the person that I still get choked up, obviously, when I think about it. And I was lonely and I didn't know that many people. And I, you know, I found out 3 days after he passed that I needed to go back to Pennsylvania for 3 weeks for this training program for this pharmaceutical job. And I did it and I was successful in doing it. And the funny thing is I needed to be tested for pot and I barely passed the test because I was able to stop smoking long enough to get clean so that it wouldn't come up on the test. And I did the training and I had this great pharmaceutical job and I got caught stealing Vicodin and I got fired and it was just horrific. And I went to a well-renowned recovery place out in the desert and I did outpatient. And that's how I first really got introduced to AA. And, you know, my husband came to the family program. My husband then, we're now divorced, but he went to the family program and he said to me, you know, Sarah, I don't know that you're really an alcoholic. I think you hit a really bad time. Your father died and, you know, you went through this horrible change in your life and you didn't have any friends there. We didn't. And I wanted to sign on for that immediately. I'm like, no, I don't really have a problem. So I did outpatient and I did 30 days without alcohol, but not exactly. In the midst of that, on one weekend, I did have a vodka soda with my mother who was visiting, but I knew it would wash out of my system in 24 hours. And I just wanted to be, I just didn't want to be an alcoholic. I was just in denial over the whole thing. So I did the 30 days to get everybody off my back. And not long after I was out of the outpatient, I went to maybe two or three meetings. Unfortunately, the meetings that I showed up to, I felt like there was a lot of complaining. But, you know, I now know being 6.5 years sober, I look back on it, I just wasn't ready. And meanwhile, in the midst of all that, my brother, who's got a couple of years more than I do of sobriety, he didn't show up for a family function and I knew something was wrong. And I ended up admitting him to that same recovery place out in the desert. And again, I'm like, you know, that's his problem, but it's not mine. I'm not the alcoholic. My brother has it, but not me. And you know, again, just more and more denial. I just didn't want to see that I had a problem. And I look back on it now and I realize that, you know, alcohol really had turned into my best friend. I could be highly functional during the day and go and do a really good job at my job. But, you know, come 5 o'clock and 5 o'clock would get earlier, you know, it was on. And it used to be a couple of glasses of wine, but that easily went to a bottle. And then where I could get my hands on it, I'd also see if I could get some pot or whatever I could mix with it. I also would get prescriptions for like Xanax and that kind of thing. And I'd go through the Xanax way quicker than, you know, you're supposed to. And it was just a mess. You know, I look back on those years and I just think, you know, it was slowly, slowly and slowly becoming a bigger part of my life. And, you know, had I not had kids, had I not had the responsibility of raising a family and a husband that was so patient, I probably would have hit my bottom a lot sooner. But I, you know, the one thing I always wanted was children. You know, it was important for me too to have a career, but I always wanted children. And so I look back on it and I think that they really just saved me in so many ways. And again, I'm getting kind of emotional because they continue to be that in my life. They're so supportive of my sobriety. And I'm really grateful for that. But what ended up happening was I got back on my feet after losing that pharmaceutical job. And, you know, they say in the book, I don't remember exactly where, in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that we have the uncanny ability to, you know, rise from the ashes and get these great jobs. And I got this really wonderful job as a marketing director for a high-end shopping center. And I was good at it, you know, and I was reinventing myself. And I thought, oh, that alcohol problem, you know, that isn't really that big a deal. It really was because of everything I went through. And at this stage, you know, my brother was well into the program and doing well. And, you know, I really give my brother Jim a lot of credit. He never made me feel, he led me in gently, you know, he didn't, we're a program of attraction. And he's definitely done that for me. He just survived a massive coronary this past summer. And I just get choked up when I think about the fact that he's still with us and still in my life and works a good program. And we enjoy, as we age, we enjoy like talking about our program. We don't do it the same. And he sometimes gets a kick out of, you know, where I go with my program, but he totally appreciates, you know, what I do. And I appreciate what he does to stay sober and to stay recovered. But anyhow, I ended up with this great job, and I really thought, you know what, I'm not an alcoholic, you know, things are back on board. On the outside, our family looked really good. My ex, you know, he had a great job. I had a great job. We had these two adorable kids. Things were going great. We had this nice little home in La Quinta. And the kids got older. And as the kids got older and needed me less physically, I found it necessary to be at many functions for work. And all those functions for work had alcohol and were required that I be social, quote unquote. And yeah, I just, you know, I look back and I think of the times that other people, you know, carpooled my kids because I knew I was too drunk to pick them up. And having said that, I want to stay honest. I know there were times that I drove them buzzed or drove them drunk. And for that, I'm, you know, by the grace of God, I never had an accident with them. I look back and my ex, you know, I was in charge of that shopping center. We had a lot of events. And he would come and meet me at the events. And I found out later he would follow me home because he knew after I was done running the event and when I could drink with colleagues, you know, he would be worried about me driving sober and he'd follow me home. And I'm always grateful to him for how he cared for me and watched out for me. You know, time went on and I think the catalyst really for me getting sober ultimately was our daughter. She was one of those people that just effortlessly seemed to move through school and get good grades and do really well. And she got accepted to USC Film School and went off and was having her college experience. And our son was home, and my husband, my ex now, but at the time he was becoming more and more ill, and it was getting to be harder and harder. And our son, you know, understandably, he just felt lost. And I started seeing in him a lot of my, you know, a lot of my character defects, which is, you know, drinking and smoking pot. And I think probably the thing that's the hardest for me, and he laughs at it, and some of his friends do too, but I was starting to steal his pot. And, you know, I found out later, was on the phone with our daughter, and he's like, you know, mom is stealing my pot. And our daughter's like, no, you know, mom couldn't be doing that, but I was. And the heck of it was, is like, I was into, you know, we're going to have a clean and sober home. We had him in therapy. We were going to something called, I think it's called the Parent Project. And, you know, we were voluntarily doing this because we felt like he was spinning out of control. And at the same time, you know, my ex, he was just getting sicker and sicker. And I look back on it now and I was getting sicker and sicker. And it was just this perfect storm waiting to happen. And ultimately what ended up happening is I felt like, you know, how can I expect my son to be clean and sober when his mother can't even? And I did all these things to try to get my husband better. And I don't know, I look back now and my sponsor tells me, you know, do you see how you're playing God, Sarah? Do you see how you're playing God? And when I was first sober, I never understood that. I was like, what do you mean trying to play God, you know? Because I prided myself on being somebody who had a solution for everything. You know, go out and do this and that'll be better. Go out and do that and this will be better. And I'm a list maker, I'm a planner. And I thought I could make everything better. And, you know, it's interesting. I've always had a God in my life. But you know, I'm a fan of Jesus Calling and I read that every morning. And it wasn't uncommon for me to, like, you know, take a hit or two off a joint and be reading Jesus Calling in the morning with a cigarette outside in our backyard. And I look back on that now and I mean, I don't know whether to laugh or cry, but I don't feel like he's ever left me. And I'm kind of going through something right now in my sobriety where, You know, I think I shared with you about how I love to listen to Lydia, her tape, and she speaks about how she's not a religious person. She's more a spiritual person, you know, but she's open to all the different religions. And, you know, I grew up so Catholic. It's such a part of me and I love it. I happen to love what was shown to me through Catholicism, the forgiveness and the understanding, and the religious people I've had in my life have been wonderful people. But I know that there's something that's also there that maybe doesn't serve me. So I'm going through something right now with God where I'm like, you know, it's less about me understanding you and knowing that you understand me. And I guess all that to say that I'm just working on being more spiritual as opposed to being religious. But you know, my Irish Catholic roots are so ingrained in me that sometimes I kind of struggle with it a little bit. But anyhow, all that to say, you know, I just prayed and prayed, and we had these great, we had a great therapist, and we had a psychiatrist that was treating us. And I had this one night where I was like, you know, am I an alcoholic? Because I went into the therapist to talk to him about our son, and he pulled me aside and he looked at me and he said, Sarah, he goes, your family is really concerned about you. Do you know what it is? And I looked at him and I said, you know, because I'm so controlling. And he just looked at me and he said, Sarah, your family is really concerned about you. Do you know why? And I just looked at him and I said, because of my alcohol, because of my drinking. And he said, yeah, that's right. So he just said to me, and, you know, I still call this man every year and thank him for my sobriety. And I'm so grateful to our son, because there we were in therapy for our son. But this man, who is a therapist and also in recovery himself, you know, he got me back to meetings. So I went back to a meeting, but again, my pride was there and I didn't want to have to go to meetings all the time. And I didn't want to have to get a sponsor, and I thought I could detox on my own. So I decided to detox on my own, and I essentially fell apart, whatever that looked like as far as falling apart is all kind of... It's a 5-day nightmare when I look back on it. I decided to get sober, and I the whole weekend is a lost weekend to me. And then on Monday, when I was supposed to get to work, I slept through it. And at one stage, I did make it to work, but there were auditors there, and my boss was out of town. And the auditors were asking me, you know, how was work going? And I ended up telling this auditor that I was in recovery and basically spilled my whole story to him. I mean, I just look back and I'm like, they must have just looked at this woman and said, oh my God, what do we do? She's the manager in charge. And I mean, I was detoxing in front of them is what was happening. And that boss that I'm talking about right now, he's a pivotal part of my recovery too. He never gave up on me, and we're still friends to this day. You know, I just look back on like my whole work environment, you know, all through my drinking years, and what bosses and what companies must have put up with me. And I'm really humbled. So anyhow, long story short, I did end up losing that job, but not because of that boss. We had been bought out by another company, and understandably the chaos that was going on in that office, I wasn't all of it, but I was part of it. And they eventually found it necessary to let me go. Although they did, they gave me a really good package and wished me well. And, you know, on some level, it was a relief, but I had to, like, you know, basically reinvent myself. I ended up getting 5150 through the detox. And, you know, the book talks about where does our alcoholism leave it. Lead us, you know, death, institutions, jail. And so institutions for me is my bottom. I was 5150 twice. And when I look back on being in those hospitals, it still just scares me. You know, they were doing their best to treat me, but my family, they showed up for me in ways that I'll forever be grateful. and a really good friend of mine too, from my early years working. She showed up because she called my husband, and he was like, oh, you know, Eileen, Sarah's really sick. And she found me. And Maureen was there for me too. And my family was just really worried about me. And all that first like 6 months of my sobriety is a little bit garbled in my mind, because they had to treat me with some drugs to keep me stable. But I really had a psychotic break. And when I look back on it, I'm still really humbled. So, you know, I finally got back into the rooms. And apparently I asked so many people to sponsor me that I don't even remember. So I look back on that and I crack up. I was going up to people, will you be my sponsor? And then I forget that I asked them. And at some stage, I met Judy, who is my sponsor and has been since the beginning. And I'll start to cry again because she's been such a big part of my life. But she said, you know, I'll work with you. But she right away was like, you know, you need to get in the book. And she got me in the book. And I'm in a line of sponsorship where we answer questions about the book. And it kind of, we do daily calls, and that's, you know, for the first, oh, I want to say month or two, that's basically what you're doing for the first, you know, 164 pages of the book. And I was a little bit pissed off at the beginning. I'm like, I don't want to have to call somebody at 8:30 every morning and answer questions about a book that I really don't get. And another thing that makes me laugh is one time I was in a meeting and I just had it. And I said, you know, this Bill and Bob and Bob and Bill, and who are they anyway? And I was just like, I look back at it and I just go, God, you know, all the patience that people had with me to get sober, it just amazes me to this day. And the line of sponsorship I'm in, we truly believe in giving back through sponsorship. So I do have a sponsee. I've had times in my sobriety where I've actually had several sponsees, and they haven't always stuck. And you know, what's interesting about it is I end up learning far more from them. And I didn't believe that at the beginning. So that's another thing that, you know, my brain gets me into a lot of overthinking. And when I overthink, it's just not good. And sometimes I'd get into meetings and I'd see that sign that would say think, think, think. And I would just throw my hands up and be like, I can't think anymore. I'm just going to get myself into more trouble. But what I'm really grateful for is Judy just kept saying, you know, Sarah, keep showing up, keep doing the work, you know, keep trusting me. And I followed her direction. And, you know, I moved through the steps and had sponsees along the way. And, you know, I just kept doing the deal. And I've had four jobs or five jobs now in sobriety. And it's just been so difficult. The whole work thing has really just been a journey. And, I think most recently what's happened on that end of things is I really decided at one stage, you know, I'm just unhappy here in the desert. My kids have moved. I found it necessary to leave my husband. We both just together, it wasn't good for my sobriety. And he knows that. It was really difficult on my kids. My sponsor moved me through the divorce, you know, with honesty, with my head held high. And he and I are now healing, and I feel like our 25 and our 28 year old, I feel like they're healing now too. But I had the opportunity to get an interview with an airline, and that would get me back to LA. And this was about a year and a half ago. And I came out to LA and I did the interview and I got called to training. And I made up my mind, you know, I'm going to see if I can live with my sister and see if she won't mind, because I won't be there all the time. So I can't get on her nerves too much. And I'll do the training and I'll see if this is something I want to do. And I'm in my late 50s. So I think it's by the grace of God that I even thought that maybe I could do this. And funny enough, I was on a flight to an annual retreat that we have. And I was with my sponsor and we were all excited about how possibly I could do this job. And one of my sober sisters, and they were saying, yeah, you know, you could totally do this job. So my brother helped me pack things up and put stuff into storage. And I moved in with my sister and I go away to training and, you know, COVID hits. So we all got called out of training. And I don't know, I was like, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I want to go back, because it was really hard on me. My daughter essentially said, you know, Mom, you went away to college. But, you know, the one thing I've done throughout my sobriety is the prayer and the meditation every day. And that was really getting me through. Also calling other alcoholics. I was like, you know, I would just call my sober sisters. I would call people I had met and I'd say, you know, I'm struggling. I have roommates, you know, I'm over 50. I'm struggling with these tests and these drills. And I don't know if this is for me anymore. Then it gets called off due to COVID. I get back with my sister and, you know, we've been living COVID, which, you know, as we all have been in the midst of, you know, what an experience. And through the whole thing, I kept thinking, you know, I don't have to make up my mind now. And my sponsor kept telling me, you don't have to make up your mind now, whether you're going to go back or not. Just, you know, live in the day, stay in the day. And, you know, it's interesting. If I was to say one of the biggest things in my recovery these days is my prayer and my meditation is my drink. You know, it used to be that I had to have a little of something to get through the day, especially with the progression of the disease. And with the progression of my recovery, what I'm learning is I need a little bit of something throughout the day that's spiritual to get me through. And I don't do it perfectly. And Lord knows that there are days I'm like, what the heck am I doing? But I keep showing up. And I think that the 24 hours and, you know, just staying in the day has really helped me. So then this past summer, I met up with my kids and my ex at the beach to have a beach day. And it was a really pivotal day because it was the first time we were all going to be together as a family since the divorce. And my sister came along and we're having this beautiful day at the beach. And I got, I was boogie boarding and I got just spit out by this wave. And I ended up having emergency back surgery. I broke my back. And I was like, I can't believe this is happening. But, you know, I called my sponsor right away in the ER because I was all nervous about the painkillers. And that whole experience with breaking my back, I can't even tell you, you know, the way my kids rallied around me and my ex and my family, and they just kept saying, you know, Sarah, you're going to be okay. I'm lucky I'm walking. I'm lucky I'm alive. And I was on the phone every day with my sponsor so I could get weaned off the pain meds because I love pain meds. Part of my story, too, is I used to come out and visit my sister and steal her pain meds and, you know, combine that with wine or combine that with vodka or whatever, you know, I could get my hands on. But I got through that. And lo and behold, I got called back to training about a month and a half ago in the middle of a pandemic, mind you. And my sponsor knew. She's like, you know, I'm like, Judy, I don't want to go back. And she's like, you know, we both decided if I didn't go back, and also another sober sister of mine who used to be in the airline industry, if I don't go back, I'll never know. You know, I need to just keep showing up. I need to just, you know, I just need to keep showing up and leave the results to him. And so I went back to training and I passed all the exams. And so now I'm going to be based in Seattle, which should be really interesting. I'm due to fly out next week. I have one more final test in the air, the last two legs of the trip to get certified. But I'm just really humbled by where I am. The longer I'm sober, the more I realize that, you know, I just don't know a lot. I think I know a lot, but I don't, and I need to listen to other people, and through other people and their storytelling, you know, that's where I learn, you know, that's where I get my sustenance. And also I heard a speaker once say that, my religion, let's see, something, God is love and my religion is gratitude. And I unabashedly stole that because the longer I'm sober, I just want God to be love. And my sponsor once said to me, you know, Sarah, put your hand on your heart. That's where God is. And so that's what I'm trying to remember now. And then, you know, if I can get into gratitude, typically my day goes better. And if I can get out of self, typically my day goes better. So, I feel like maybe I was all over the place, but that's basically, you know, my story. I I try not to look too far ahead, because the only thing I've had that's been consistent through my sobriety is change. You know, all it's been about is change. And I've had so many people along the way, you know, including, you know, Maureen, who's my good friend who spoke on this podcast, who was there for me when I first got sober. And I have all these faces flashing in front of me right now of people that just really have helped me. I've met some new friends here in Santa Monica that have helped me with my sobriety. They both happen to be Sheila. Both their names are Sheila, and they've got some long-term sobriety. And just the speakers that I listen to, and, you know, the fact that we can all get on these Zoom meetings, that helps me immensely. So I'll just wrap it up with that. That's where I am right now. I don't know what the future holds. I'm just going to keep showing up. You know, I think I mentioned earlier, I don't feel like I ever had a pink cloud, because I've had my struggles. And I would love to say that most days I'm a grateful alcoholic. I don't always feel that way, because I do sometimes miss those party days. But when I look back, when I look at the last 5 years and how hopeless I felt, I don't ever want to go back there. So I'm just going to keep showing up. So with that, that's it. Thanks, Tara.
Thank you, Sarah. That was great. It wasn't all over the place. It was fun to listen to. And I love the image of you smoking a joint reading Jesus Calling. That's just hilarious. And you mentioned the counselor who just pulled you aside and just said, your family's concerned. Do you know why? And forced you to come up with the answer, you know, just the, come on, these are things I will take with me indefinitely. And perhaps we can get Jim on sometime to share his experience, strength, and hope. I do have a
couple. He would love that.
Oh, good. Oh, good. That'd be great. I do have a couple of questions, and I feel like, cause you know, I have a huge ego and I know everything, that I know the answer to it, but I really probably don't. What I feel like I'd like to hear more about, or at least have a better understanding as to why you used and drank, because you didn't just, you know, wasn't just, I just don't understand. There's alcohol and there's pot and there's Vicodin and there's Xanax and there's like this constant need to escape. But I didn't quite get from your story what, and maybe it wasn't an escape. Maybe you just like partying and that was it. Like you had mentioned when you're driving in the car, smoking a cigarette when you're 19, 20 years old and you're listening to the music and you're like, this feels so good. Maybe it just felt good and that's why you did it. But I'm guessing at some point it didn't feel good anymore, but you kept doing it. Do you know why?
You know, probably the reason why I didn't touch on it, it's kind of a an interesting thing. I'm really careful about not blaming, you know, what was happening in my marriage, because I think I mentioned that, you know, my ex was really ill and, you know, initially I think the parting was fun. And then I think somewhere I heard, you know, first it's fun, then there's problems, then it's just problems. And I also think that the reason why I didn't, you know, I'm so careful not to blame him because I don't want to get into the blame game, but I just couldn't stand what I was seeing with him and how sick he was getting. And I also suspected that we didn't really have a marriage. And, you know, I was raised with a beautiful marriage as an example. My parents weren't perfect. Again, they were not perfect, but they really loved each other. And I really thought that that's what I would have. I thought I would have 50 years, you know, with him, and it wasn't working out. So that's part of it. The other part of it is I've often heard speakers share how they were always not comfortable, like always feeling like I didn't fit in. And that's definitely part of who I am. So maybe I was an alcoholic from the very beginning, you know, but always feeling like, okay, I don't quite fit in, trying too hard to be liked. I think I'm addicted to approval. You know, even now in my sobriety, I'm like, you know, a lot of times I'm just, you know, does everybody like me? Did I say the right thing in the meeting? You know, oh my gosh, did that person, you know, I mean, I still have a long way to go in terms of being comfortable in my own skin and feeling and filling that inner need. I also think, Tara, that, I have that. And my sponsor and I talk about this because she feels that the longer I'm sober, I will be grateful for it, because I have this insatiable need in me. The same need that has me wanting to feel good all the time is also maybe the hole in me where I'm seeking God, you know? And so, the smoking and the drinking and the partying and everything, you know, maybe all along it was just that need in me to feel good. And maybe what that is that need to feel, you know, that I'm one with my creator, that I'm going to be okay. So that's a very long, convoluted answer, but that's what that is.
No, I feel like you were honest. The towards the end of your answer, you were getting more and more and more honest. And I actually wrote down filling that inner need. Excuse me. You talk about your religion now, and I also grew up Catholic, didn't have a good or bad experience, but it didn't fill up that need to be close to my creator. And when you were talking about the music and the car, and you're like, this just feels so good. When I feel that good today, it's when I'm so connected with my higher power, and there's synchronicity, and like I'm flowing, and I'm God's communicating with me, and it feels like I'm not alone. I'm just so connected. And that high is what I was seeking in alcoholism.
Yep.
And it sounds like, you know, perhaps you have that same high that we get when we're just close to our creator, close to source, close to love. And, and I think that, I'm excited to see where I'm excited to see where your program, where your religious and spiritual program goes from here, as you take on this whole new job, being around totally different energy sources. You're going to be in Seattle. You're going to be around so many people. It's just going to be, it's going to be a ride for you this year. Literally.
You know, what's interesting too, Tara, is, the airline that, I'm working for, of course I have to pass the last, I'll put out there, anybody listening, good vibes that I passed this last in-flight test. They have a strong recovery program, and one or two people in training with me know I'm in recovery. And one particular person said to me, you know, Sarah, you should contact them so you can, you know, be a part of this. And I kind of laughed and I said, I want to, but I need to pass all my tests first. Like, let's not put the cart before the horse.
That's right.
But they have a really strong recovery program. And, you know, my sponsor has said to me, you know, who knows, Sarah, you know, maybe you'll be out there helping other, you know, flight attendants stay sober. And when I was in training last month, the person who heads up that program came in and spoke with us, and she's awesome. She's just wonderful. And she shared that during this time of COVID in particular, you know, there were a lot of people in the industry that were suffering, a lot of people that had to go into rehab, a lot of families that were struggling. And I'm excited to see how I can be of service, you know, and I hope it's within, you know, again, within the airline industry, and that this is the right thing for me. I just keep saying, I'm a big fan of the set aside prayer, because my sponsor kept saying to me, you know, Sarah, just set aside everything you think you know about training, everything you think you know about your recovery, so that you can leave it up to God. So we'll see. I think what I love is that, you know, we can be all over the place with what, you know, and maybe that's what I'm going through right now with my religion of origin. You know, it's like, I don't want to abandon it, because I mean, when I had to divorce, it was just so hard. And I went to our priest and he was amazing, you know. And when I got sober, I went to our priest and he was so loving and so kind, you know. And in fact, I went to three priests and one of them was not shocked that I was in the program. And I was like, okay, you know, I could have at least, you know, seen a little bit of surprise on his face when I told him I was in AA. But anyway, you know, it doesn't, yeah, right. But, you know, this is the thing that I guess I love about, you know, how I was raised. Like, you know, AA doesn't kick anyone to the curb ever. You know, it's all inclusive. And that's what I have found with my religion of origin. You know, they never shut their door on anyone, you know, and that's where the love comes. You know, that's where I'm like, I just want to be, I want to find that mix between being comfortable with my faith of origin and my religion of origin. But I want so much more spirituality, because I mean, there's so many oxymorons in the program, like the very thing that is my strength, you know, like my stubbornness and me wanting to do it my way and me having a plan for everything and wanting to be organized, you know, all those very things have served me in my program, meaning like the line of sponsorship I'm in, you know, we're required to do certain things every day and that works for me, you know, so and then I end up backing off all of it and saying, you're thinking too much, Sarah, just show up and do the next indicated thing.
I wonder if the origins of Catholicism and how spiritual my understanding is when it began would be of interest to you. So I don't think you have to choose between one or the other. I think Catholicism is different than what it was when it originated.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that I'm hoping for, one of the reasons why I was drawn to the industry, to the airline industry, is I really, really hope to go to the Holy Land. You know, I would love to do that. And I don't think it needs to be a choice either. I think that, you know, I'm just in this place right now where I'm like, you know, I want to listen more instead of trying so hard, you know, and again, instead of trying to understand him, you know that he gets me.
And will provide.
Mm-hmm. But I love that you said that, because I don't think it needs to be a choice either. And I think that when we talk to each other as one alcoholic to another, you know, and when I've talked to, like, there's this wonderful Irish nun, her name is Sister B, and then another lovely Irish nun. I know I'm drawn to Irish people. Again, I'm fifth generation. But there's another one, her name is Sister Ada Garrity. And these two women, you know, have both said that when we talk to our sponsor or when we talk to people in the program, the idea that when two or more of us are gathered, you know, that we're hearing him. And so I love that you said I don't have to choose, because it reminds me that I don't, and that I can let go.
When I want to feel comfortable and safe, I shag my ass down to a Catholic church.
Yeah.
Just go in there and sit in there, light a candle, pray. It's not my choice of religion today, but it is my foundation of religion, and there's still a lot of comfort there.
Yeah. I think that's what it is for me. Like, I look back, like right now I'm sitting in my sister's living room, and like, I'm so grateful for my family of origin and my religion of origin, because you know, again, we weren't perfect, but I'm looking at this family picture right now. And then I have another picture next to me of my kids. And, you know, my parents were just such good people, and they lived their faith. And, you know, my sister upstairs right now, who's 10 years older than I am, and I don't know where I would be without her. You know, I mean, I needed to leave the desert. It was time for me to go. And, you know, COVID hit, and I'm looking for a new job, and there are people homeless now, and there's so much going on in the world that's so far beyond anything that we can control. And I just, you know, I want to remember to just, you know, stay grateful. And and you're helping me do that right now.
Well, you're definitely helping me stay sober today, and I appreciate that. It's
Thanks,
been a pleasure.
Tara, thank you.
Before I let you off the hook, though, I have one final question.
Sure, sure.
What do you want to say to the alcoholic that's listening now, still out there suffering?
My sponsor used to always say that honesty would always serve me. When I would get all twisted and turned around, she'd say to me, you know, Sarah, if you stay honest with me, it's going to be okay. So I would tell the alcoholic out there who's suffering that, you know, you are so loved, you know, that God just loves each and every one of us, every hair in our head. And you know, if you can stay honest, if you know that God loves you, and if you can find a sponsor, that's those three things right there you know, and just that you're loved.
For more information, read the first 164 pages of The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous or visit keepcomingback.net.